This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. If someone were to suggest that biological differences between men and women explain why there are no female linebackers in the National Football League, it wouldn't raise an eyebrow. But when the president of Harvard suggested in a meeting earlier this month that biology might explain why women are lagging behind men when it comes to careers in science, he got an earful. There's no question that women are underrepresented on university science faculties. A 1999 study of gender equity in MIT's School of Science gave the bleak numbers. 90% of the tenured faculty were male. A 2001 study at Caltech came up with similar stats. Only 11% of the professional faculty were women. So the question is, why? In this hour, we talk about the reasons why with people who have not only studied the question, but also have firsthand knowledge of the problem confronting women in science. And as always, we'd like to hear your opinions. Perhaps some of you have had experiences that will shed light on this question. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. If you want more information about what we'll be talking about this hour, go to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Now, let me introduce my guests. First, Nancy Hopkins is the Amgen, Inc. Professor of Biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. She joins me today by phone from her office there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hopkins.
Thank you.
Next, Marianne Bronner-Fraser is the Ruddock Professor of Biology at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, and she joins me today from the campus there. Welcome to the program, Dr. Bronner-Fraser.
Thank you, Joe.
And third is Meg Urey. She's a professor of physics in the director of the Yale Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. She joins us today by phone from Hunter College here in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I hope you're warm there at Hunter College because it's pretty cold in New York today.
Brutal.
Anyway, Nancy Hopkins, I'd like to start with you. You know, we talk about the pipeline where young people are flowing into a various profession, and certainly there's a pipeline in science, but they talk about the leaky pipeline for women in science. What are we talking about?
Well, the picture they're describing there is the fact that the fraction of undergraduate women in science has been high for quite a long time, but when you look at the faculty, it's been low for a long time. And I think people thought that when the numbers rose in the undergraduate body and then rose in the PhD population, that we would see that translate to the faculty in a reasonable period of time, and it just didn't happen.
So, in other words, people are coming in, but somewhere between starting a career in science and actually getting a job in science, they drop out.
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And, I mean, is there any indication of where the losses are occurring? I mean, if you've made the commitment, for example, to spend, you know, 5 or 6 years getting a PhD, it seems to me at that point you've got a lot of incentive to go on. Are they going to industry, perhaps, or are they just leaving the field altogether?
I think myself that for the particular group of people we've studied and that we're talking about, which is people at these research universities, looking at the faculty of these research universities, we're not really sure. All we do know is that the fraction of people at each stage is fewer women at each as you go up the ladder. And we're not completely sure where they go. We just know they go somewhere else.
Well, Dr. Bronner-Fraser, maybe I can ask you, have you either got evidence or an opinion about what's happening to these women who enter the field but somehow don't wind up in a career, at least an academic career? I guess we have to make that distinction.
Well, I'm a biologist, and in biology, 50% of our graduate students are female, and in general, to go on for an academic career, people do postgraduate work as well, and 50% of our postdocs are also female. So it looks like the drop-off is somewhere between the getting a job in academics at an assistant professor level and that postdoctoral level. I'm sure that this is now my opinion. Some people definitely do go into industry, but I know a number of women who just decide at that point that it might be they at least view it as a very difficult career move, and they decide to opt out at that point. And I think our charge is to try to keep those women in the loop somehow, if not in academics, at least in some sort of scientific research.
But more difficult than any other career? I mean, you know, becoming a banker or becoming an accountant or a lawyer, don't they present problems as well? Is there a special thing about science that makes it particularly difficult?
Well, from my perspective, I actually think it's a wonderful career, and there are lots of great advantages. I think we have to be proactive in letting people know what the advantages are to an academic career. And perhaps we're failing in some way. But, you know, it's a hard question because I think a lot of the problems are perceived problems, and you know, they feel like one has to make choices between career and family in going into academics. I don't think that's necessarily true, but I think we have an image problem in a way.
Dr. Yuri, maybe I can turn to you as the physical scientist and say, are the problems that the biologists you were describing familiar to you, or is there a different set of issues in the physical sciences?
I think it's a matter of degree. In physics, I live in the desert, meaning that it's the lowest percentage of women of any of the scientific fields, and so the problems are a little more acute, and the big drop-off for us happens between high school and undergraduate years. The half the students taking high school physics are girls, and only about 20% of the physics majors are girls or women. And then the percentage, as Nancy said, decreases as you go up in level. I would say, but we see the same issues. We see, you know, some level of discouragement and opting out for various reasons, among which I think are lack of mentoring, lack of encouragement, and so on. But there's also the issue of, the gatekeepers not opening the doors widely for the women who want to go through. There are young, extremely talented women physicists who do not break in to the academic scene.
This is one of those questions where if you ask the department chairman in any physics department, would you discriminate against a woman candidate, that person would say, oh, don't be ridiculous, of course not. But you're saying it's a de facto problem, It's just very hard to pin down in that case.
Well, I think all of us like to think we're unbiased, and I wish it were true, but there's just a huge amount of research that shows otherwise. I mean, you could test me, you could test you, and we all have implicit assumptions about who's a leader, who's a scientist. I mean, if I ask you to picture a scientist in your mind, I'm sure it looks more like Einstein than like Marie Curie. And those things are just inherent in growing up in this society. So they don't go away just because you will them to do so. So when people evaluate candidates for hiring, for example, there are very strong biases that play in there, and the woman's talk may not be perceived as great as the man's talk, even when they're word for word identical.
Interesting. All right. Well, we'd like to hear what our listeners have to say, and feel free to call us on this topic. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's see if we go to hear Debbie in Vista, California. Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I had two comments that sort of follow right on the end of the last comment. First of all, I think it's a perception in the science world that, you know, men in particular keep women down, maybe not. But I found as I came up through the ranks of in the science field, and I'm a civil engineer, which is, it's a terrible good old boys club. Anyway, I found that I was probably discouraged and held back more by women than I was by men. That was just very strange to me.
So Dr. Hopkins, maybe can you understand that point of view at all?
Well, I think it's a little bit unusual, but I will make the following comment about it, and that is that this kind of unconscious bias that Meg Urey was talking about was, in a way, the thing that was discovered by the MIT report, and that it came as such a shock to people, including the people, I should say, who wrote the report, I think. I think most of us don't really believe easily in bias. It's unconscious and invisible, and particularly in the sciences, which we think of being merit-based, you know. And I think this unconscious bias is a real phenomenon. And what's interesting about it is it turns out it isn't limited at all to men. Women and men hold these biases, because these are really societal views. And so that comment the person just made, the caller, when I went traveling around the country after this report from MIT came out and so many people were interested in it because so many women resonated with it and understood it, that was a common question I got, and I was at first quite surprised because I wasn't aware at that time about all the research on this bias. But it is held, these views, equally by men and women.
Dr. Bronner-Fraser, have you experienced that as well? Can you make real this bias, or can you describe it better?
Well, instead of thinking of it as a bias, I like to think of it as benign neglect in a way, because I think that I don't think there's overt discrimination, but I think that a lot of times if you ask somebody who they would like to hire, say you call a colleague and say, do you have a great new postdoc coming along who might be good for our job? A lot of times they inherently first think of the men. And if you phrase it a little differently and say, do you have a great person coming through your lab, and in particular we're looking for very good women, you get a totally different response. And so one of the things that I'm quite encouraged about is since the MIT report has come out and Caltech has done a report as well, one of our focuses has been to try to increase the numbers of women. And it's a slow job to do that. We went from 11% in 2001 to 13% in 2004. And that's a small increase, but I think it happened because we started paying more attention to the problem. So I think that there is some kind of bias. We really don't know very much about it, but it's something that can be overcome if you notice it and think about it and try to get around it.
Joe, could I step in here with a
perhaps
a description?
Yes, Meg Geary.
Thanks.
Yes.
In fact, the social scientists have been doing this research for a long time, and I'm not an expert. I'm sort of a great reader of these things. There are a lot of good experiments where, for example, you send resumes out for a job, and you just randomly assign male or female names to the resumes which have equal qualifications, and the men are preferred many times over the women. You can do even more things that are even more directly applicable to, say, hiring a faculty member. There's an experiment which shows two people giving the same job talk, and the man is rated much higher than the woman, even though the talk's identical. So there are many examples of this kind of bias that have been measured.
Dr. Geary, we're going to have to take a short break, but we're going to talk about those and other topics. This is an hour where we hope to explore some of the reasons and obstacles women face in science, scientific career. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about women and science, and joining me now to talk about how male and female brains differ and whether that may have something to do with why women have in general lagged behind men in scientific careers is Nicole Weeks, an associate professor of psychology at Pomona College in Claremont, California. I don't know, is it an obligation that I say that I went to Pomona College where I was a psychology undergraduate? Maybe I should.
I think it is.
Okay, well, in that case, the biases are on the table, at least in this particular case. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Weeks.
Thank you so much. I'm pleased to be with you.
So, first of all, I mean, there are clear differences physiologically in male and female brains. Isn't that true?
Yes, I would say that is true. I think when you talk about the types of things that neuropsychologists and other brain scientists have investigated directly, we've looked at things like the size of particular areas of the brain, differences in the size of the two hemispheres of particular parts of the brain in men and women, the size of particular types of tissue, that is things like gray matter versus white matter in males and females. And it certainly is the case that you do find some differences there. And we can go into the particulars of that if you'd like. But I think what becomes problematic is when you make these several jumps from differences in the size of the brain to what that means about specific cognitive functions, and then a much larger jump, it seems to me, to what that means about the ability to excel in scientific courses and in a career in the sciences.
Yeah, I guess as a psychologist, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, one is bigger than another, but
sure.
it becomes a little bit like phrenology. You're just sort of feeling the top of the head and making predictions. But what would it take I mean, if you were going to design an experiment, how would you design one that would tell you, oh, yes, the biology is an important component in predicting a future outcome?
Well, that's a great question. It's funny because I was thinking about President Summers' comments, and I might have a slightly different reaction to his comments than some of my colleagues do. And that is, in some ways, I think if he had posed it as a question, exactly in the way that you just did it, I might have said, that's a wonderful question. So how do we go about testing that particular prediction scientifically? And the thing to remember is, if you want to be scientific about these things, you really can only look at one factor at a time. So if you really want to look at the innateness of these effects, you need to find a way to control the environment. So what you would have to argue is, in order to think about these things as being biological in nature, or more specifically, genetically predisposing in nature, you would have to find a way to equal out all these things that your other panelists have talked about. That is, the difference to the exposure to particular types of environments, the difference in the exposure to different mentors, the number of mentors you have and the strength of that mentoring, whether you're encouraged or discouraged throughout your education and once you start your career. So until those things are equaled out between the two sexes, I think you really can't have the kind of study that one would need to see in order to test Summers' hypothesis, if you want to put it that way.
Right. But would you, I mean, you wouldn't be surprised, I presume, that there was some contribution from biological differences. I mean, I guess the question is how big a difference, but some difference or some effect I would expect you would find.
Right. Well, let me say a couple of things about that. One is, let's go back a couple of steps to what do we know, okay? So what we know in terms of where males and females differ in performance, if you will, is mostly on specific cognitive abilities, and that has been very well investigated. So we can talk about the things like verbal ability, verbal fluency, verbal memory, things like that, and the idea that there have been a number of studies over several different labs and many years arguing that females excel at these particular types of specific cognitive abilities. We could make a similar argument for visuospatial ability, for instance, and some level of mathematical reasoning for males. And that is, there is strong evidence, especially for visuospatial ability, but also for mathematical reasoning, depending on the way in which you look at the data, mm-hmm. to suggest that males may be better at these types of tasks on average, all right? And there have been a number of labs to look at what the relationship might be between the differences that have been found in brain regions and the differences in these cognitive abilities. I think what becomes problematic, though, is, to my knowledge, no one has found the area of the brain responsible for scientific achievement, right? So the problem is not whether or not there are sex differences in specific cognitive ability, and more so whether or not there are sex differences in the brain, but instead making that connection and then arguing from there, if there's a biological basis in this case, there must be a biological basis in terms of these far more complicated questions of who excels in a career in science.
Right.
Could I step in and say something there, Joe?
Well, sure. Yes, of course. Go ahead.
This is
Nancy
Hopkins.
Yes.
Yes, I thought that was a wonderful comment, and I just wanted to add something that my colleague, former colleague now at Harvard, Professor Spelke, has said about this matter. I think she would agree probably with everything you just said, but I think that what she also added to me in a long exchange we've been having is that these differences that have been detected, even these gender differences, are extremely small.
That's right.
And they are far smaller than the differences due to ethnicity, social class, education, and so many other factors, and can't begin to account for the enormous gap in the math and science faculties of American universities.
Absolutely. First of all, absolutely. I completely agree with that. I also...
Is that Meg Urey?
Yes. I'm so glad Nancy made that comment.
Yes.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Let me just add one more thing, which
sure.
I'm sure that the other guests know, and that is that some of these measured differences disappear when you change the environment.
Right.
There's
yeah.
a famous math test where if you just type across the top of the math test that the test has been designed to be gender neutral, then any measured difference between males and females disappears.
Absolutely.
So
yeah. Well, I would also make the argument from the standpoint of neuroscience, so not even just these psychosocial measures. And your other panelists are absolutely right in terms of the influence of environment, social class, support, expectation, and that those effects seem to be much stronger than the effects that we've seen or the findings in terms of the size of the brain or the contribution of the size and complexity of the brain to cognitive ability. But even from a neuroscientist's standpoint, think about it this way. There have been a number of studies looking at, especially in rodents, if you take two groups of rodents and you put them in two environments, yeah? You take one group of rodents and you put them in what we'll call an impoverished environment, where they sit in their cage alone, there's no stimulation, etc. And you take another group of rodents from the same species and you put them in an enriched environment, where they have toys, where they have social interaction, etc. And you have them grow up in that environment, and then you look at the size of the brain, the complexity of parts of the brain, their performance on particular tasks at that point. What you will find, you're probably not surprised to know, is that those animals raised in an enriched environment are going to have more complex brains, larger volume of brain, and better performance on tasks. Now, how does that relate to the issues we're talking about here? Imagine this. Imagine that you have a task, and somehow females are genetically predispositioned to do 5% better on the task. And you could find the part of the brain that's related to the task and say that females have 5% greater complexity in that part of the brain. Okay, so let's say somehow we could show that. All right? Now, all you have to do is to take a group of males and a group of females, take those males and put them in the enriched environment, take those females and put them in the impoverished environment. And if you follow the logic of the rodent studies, let's say that that difference in environment makes a 10% difference in the size and the complexity of the brain and the ability on that task. You let them grow up, and what you're going to find is males, this is simplistic, but I think you follow the logic, males are going to look as though they're 5% better on the task, and wow, you're going to open the brain and see 5% greater complexity in that part of the brain responsible for the task. And what many of us, well, hopefully not the scientists, but many non-scientists might conclude is, aha, this must be biological in nature. Men are just better at the task, and somehow we might assume that that's because of innate differences, and it absolutely is not. And I think that sort of gives a little bit of flesh to these things that we're talking about, that it's not just about heritability, but it's also probably more so about the environment in which you put these individuals.
Spoken like a psychologist, Dr. Weeks. Thank you very much. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Nicole Weeks is an associate professor of psychology at Pomona College in Claremont, California, and she spoke with us from her office there. And my other guests who you've been hearing from as we were talking with Dr. Weeks are, well, I don't think we heard from Dr. Marianne Bronner-Fraser, but she's Ruddock Professor of Biology at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. We did hear from Meg Urey, who's a professor of physics and the director of the Yale Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics at Yale University in New Haven, and Nancy Hopkins from the Amgen, Inc. Professor of Biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge. And I really feel I have to take some calls here because the lines have just lit up and been, and I know this is a topic that everybody has something to say about. So let me start with Linda in Shelbyville, Kentucky. Linda, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, did I get that wrong? I'm sorry.
Linda, Shelbyville, Kentucky, yes.
Oh, so yep. This is, okay, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
What's your comment?
Well, I actually have an observation and then a question.
Okay.
I worked as a docent at the Fermi National Accelerator Lab for 5 years, and part of my job was to take student groups through the accelerators, detectors, et cetera, and at the end of every tour, they would meet with the scientists that work at Fermilab. And especially with the high school groups, the question of girls in math and girls in physics came up, and the girls would usually express, I don't know if I could do this. And the scientists there were very encouraging. And I remember a couple of them said, you know, they look for women graduate students because their experience had been that women bring a different perspective to problem solving. In other words, if they have something they're working on and they're trying to figure out an experiment or a piece of equipment or something, that they found that women engineers, women physicists brought a different way of looking at the problem that often helped them solve it. And so they expressed this quite often. So I had the impression that, wow, women are really coming into this. And there were several women physicists and experimenters at Fermilab. I did notice, however, that a lot of the other women working on special projects were mostly from European countries. I guess my question would be, is there something that they are doing in the educational process in Europe that the United States could kind of look at? Because, like I said, these scientists were looking for women to come and bring that perspective to their experiments at Fermilab.
Okay, Linda, thanks for the call. Dr. Fraser-Bronner, Bronner-Fraser.
I'm used to it. I have many names.
I'm really sorry. Is that a topic that you can speak to at all?
Absolutely. Okay. We do get a lot of both men and women from Europe, and that's largely because the job situation there is even worse than in the U.S. So I'd say that if anything, they have a lot to learn from us, because the percentage of women in higher positions in Europe is really quite dreadful. So the reason they're here is because they can't get jobs over there. That said, I think that this raises a really interesting question, and I think the educational system is the key to getting more women and minorities to go into the sciences. And I think the topic that was addressed by Nicole is really important. A lot of the women from very early ages are told that they probably are not as good in math and science as young men are. And so I think they get discouraged as time goes by, and we need to do a much better job of having them be better integrated into the system and to give them real confidence to tell them they can do this. And I think that was a very interesting comment that the caller made about how women approach problems differently. I think that there are inherent differences between men and women in how they look at things, and those can be very useful in terms of having a different perspective. It doesn't mean that women are worse in science. It means that they may, you know, approach things from a somewhat different perspective. So that would be something we should look at.
We're talking about the problems. Excuse me, Jess, I have to tell people that we're talking about the problems of women in science, and that I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Go ahead. Could I just add a word about the...
yes, this is Meg Urey.
Physics thing.
I was going to ask you to jump in there. I'm sorry.
Thanks. No. Three years ago, there was an international conference on women in physics held in Paris, and the U.S. community sent a big delegation, which I was fortunate enough to lead. And it was very, very interesting, this thing about different countries. One of the first things you see is that from country to country, the percentage of women, percentage of physicists who are women is just vastly different. And even knowing nothing else, that could tell you right off that the differences in the success of women in physics has more to do with culture than with innate ability. For example, if you just look at France and Germany, you know, those countries are very close together, similar geography, similar education level, similar technological advanced level, if you like. And in France, a very large fraction of physicists, 30 or 40%, are women. And in Germany, it's a few percent. So it's quite interesting, you know, to observe that. I would say that it's also true that in this country, physicists are quite interested in attracting women into physics, yet there are a lot of things about the profession that are unattractive on the face of it. Again, cultural factors, a kind of a snobbishness and a monastic devotion that implies you can't do anything else besides physics, which isn't true, and so on. So I think the cultural areas are where we need a little bit of work.
Okay, let me take one more quick call before we have to take a break. Denise from Virginia, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you even having this conversation. It's quite an acknowledgement, not just by the scientists in our community, but also your listeners. I'm newly relocated from New York, and I do have several women in my family who have tried very hard to enter through Albert Einstein, Columbia. There's a certain point that women seem to be able to reach, and that's true. But it's almost heartbreaking to know that discrimination because of women having families, because of lifestyle, does indeed exist. And I'm so happy that you're looking into this, because for whatever reason, we are hoping that the socialization, social pressures, does not become an excuse for making women less capable. I watch these women dedicate their lives to their medical professions in the lab, in research, giving up great sums of money and other fields such as teaching to remain in the lab and have to end up leaving.
Yep.
Because they just could not survive.
Well, Denise, it's an interesting point, and I thank you for making it. It's hard to know, really. I mean, I think we have time left in this hour, but I'd like to try to tackle some of the reasons for this departure. I mean, we all observe it. The question is, what can we do about it? But right now we have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking more about women in the sciences and the obstacles they face in pursuing careers. Stay with us. This hour, we're talking about women in science. My guests are Meg Urey, professor of physics and director of the Yale Center for Astronomy and Astrophysics, Nancy Hopkins, Amgen Inc. professor of biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, and Marianne Bronner-Fraser, Ruddock professor of biology at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. And I want to continue to give our listeners a chance to talk, so let me go to Carrie in Livermore, California. Carrie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I finished a PhD in material science about 3.5 years ago, so I'm just starting my career, and I've given the topic of women in science a lot of thought. And one thing that's occurred to me is that getting a PhD takes a long time, 5 to 7 years. It took me 7 years, so by the time I finished, I was 29. And then I do a postdoc, which is 3 years, with 3 years for me can be longer for other people. And then many people want to go on to academia, and then there's a trial period before you get tenure, and that can be 7 years. So if you add all that up, you can be 38 or 39 by the time you finally really have your first job. And many people want to have the security of a job before they start having children. And by the time, if we wait until we're 39, it's almost too late, unfortunately. So I think that's one factor that makes it difficult for women to pursue an academic career or a career in science, just that, unfortunately, our biology. And right. I've thought a lot about other careers that have traditionally attracted women, like teaching and nursing. And these are highly trained, very professional people, but they're much more interchangeable than a scientist. A scientist with a PhD has very specific skills, and they have research programs and grants that are based on those specific skills. And if you want to take some time out to maybe have children or spend time with those children, it's hard to plug someone else back into your place.
Right. Oh, Carrie, interesting point, and I think we have some interesting points of view on that. Meg Urey, if I remember correctly, you have small children,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, I have two adorable daughters.
Ah.
Getting up now. They're 11 and almost 14.
Yeah.
So I know family issues are, family is the number one reason a lot of people worry might keep women out of science. But, I have a different take on this. I think it's hard work having a family. I mean, for anybody, mm-hmm. whether you're in science or not, being woken up 3 times a night for a year is pretty exhausting. On the other hand, women in science, particularly in academia, we have an enormous flexibility and we have the resources to get some help. It seems to me it's a lot easier to have kids when you're a professor of physics than it is when you work at Walmart 40 hours a week and have much less control over your time. So, and it's also the case that women who are married and with children don't do any worse than women who are unmarried, or vice versa, let's put it this way. Women who don't have children don't succeed at a higher level than women with families. And the MIT report was a good example of that. So I think it's not the reason. I think what it is an extra way for women to opt out. If you remember the game Chutes and Ladders, it's like an extra chute for women to drop out of a profession. But for the women who stay, it's not the reason women aren't advancing in science.
I would like to ask Nancy. I would,
Nancy just, Hopkins, yes, go ahead.
I would probably differ from Meg substantially in this aspect. I don't fully agree with what she said. I agree with a lot of it, and I think it's true about the flexibility of the academic career and so forth. But I do think, because I come from an older generation than Meg, I'm probably quite a bit older, so in my generation it was much more difficult. And things really have changed in this aspect. So it's much easier now for women to be able to do it than it was at the time I started. But I think the caller's point is still a very valid one. I think there is a kind of a conflict between the pattern of the career and the timing when people want to have their children. And so there is still a problem that more of that responsibility has fallen to women than to men. And while it's changed, it still isn't really equal.
I'd like to weigh in on this issue.
Yes,
as well,
I was going to say, maybe we can get people and three opinions. That would be good.
No, I would have to side with Meg on this. I have two children, 17 and 14, and I'm sort of intermediate age. I think that I agree completely that having children balances your life in a very important way, but I feel this is really a mentoring issue. I don't think there's anything that should keep women from having a family, and in fact, I think it's a huge advantage because when you don't get your grant or when your paper gets rejected, then you still have your family, and you always have that you know, sort of to fall back on. But women do want to have children, and they shouldn't have to wait till they're in their late 30s to have their first baby. And what I think it boils down to a mentoring issue. I don't think there's anything that would prevent women from having their children earlier. You don't need to have a lined up job to have a child. You can have a child in graduate school. You can have a child when you're a postdoc. And in fact, those times also are very flexible because it's more of an apprenticeship than it is, you know, going to school. In fact, I think it's much easier to have children when you're in graduate school than it is, for example, when you're in medical school or a resident when you have a very fixed program. So we have to be able to encourage people to have their children when they feel like it instead of waiting till they feel like their careers are at a level where they can do this. One of the interesting points is I actually think that the most difficult time to have children is when you're first setting up your lab, when you get your assistant professorship, and it's actually much easier to do it at a younger time. So I think that there's nothing to prevent women from doing it all, but you have to not think yourself out of it. I think people really do psych themselves out, and that's a problem.
Interesting. Well, let's see what let's take another caller, and this time we'll go to Chip in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Well, hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question, and I'm going to kind of use my sister as an example here. My question is, I guess my observation is, that I'm wondering if there is an ego component to this faculty issue. I know several friends of mine are faculty members at universities, not in the sciences, but they tell me how incredibly competitive the application process is. There are just so few positions available. And given that difficulty, and I know I'm using a little bit of a stereotype here, but given that men tend to be a little more ego-driven and, just more driven, and maybe that's societal too, but to continue to push through that process where women might say, you know, my ego doesn't need to do this, I can go do something else, you know, in another profession, or something along those lines, you know, so that men push through. Yeah, I don't know if it's...
Yeah, I think we understand. I think I get the point, okay. Chip, and I appreciate that. I think it's an interesting question. Maybe I could ask Nancy Hopkins. Is it a problem of, you know, generating the ego to be able to stand up to some tenured faculty at MIT and say, I can do just the same as you can?
Well, I think this does come close to the issue that we started out with a little bit, and that we haven't talked about quite as much, perhaps, and that was this bias, or the nature, is this a male-dominated field, and are women comfortable in it? And I think the question really bears on that issue. And so, we know, again, it's part of this thing. We'd like to think that what's going on here is just about science and just about merit, and that what we're really doing is looking for the very best people who are going to do the very best science. But I think what we've all learned is that's a complicated question. It's not as straightforward and simple as we used to think. So, you know, a person's personality does matter. All kinds of factors enter into whether you choose it and how successful you are at it and whether you're comfortable and love it. It isn't just your passion for science and your excellence in it. And so I think the question is very relevant, and I think some of the concern in these fields, particularly like physics and math, is that the culture itself, whether it's the aggression component or some other component, is keeping women or driving them out even without them realizing it, that they're just not comfortable there, and so they leave.
But you can actually change, this is Marianne, you can change the level of comfort by putting more women in the mix. So I think this is much less of a problem in the biological sciences. And at Caltech, we have about 25% women in our department. And the culture is a little bit different because of that. And I think the problems are not as intense as they might be in the physical sciences. So I agree with the caller that you need a certain degree. I wouldn't call it ego. I would prefer to call it confidence. And I think that's something that women can acquire by good mentoring. But if you change the dynamics of the people who are searching for a new faculty member, that can really make a huge difference in the comfort level of women coming in.
But Dr. Bronner-Fraser, now I'm curious to say is there something special? Is this a particular problem for the sciences, or is any profession where women are underrepresented facing this?
I would guess that this would be a very generic problem. I think that the numbers of women in the sciences has lagged behind other professions. For example, in medicine, I think right now there's probably about 50% of women in medical school classes, and that seems to be maintained at the physician level for reasons that we're not sure of, and that's what these studies are trying to get at. We've lagged behind, so there's still a big drop-off, but I'm sure these problems are the same.
Although, Joe, I would add, in the medical profession, I'm not sure that women have made it to the very top of academic medicine. I think there they've faced similar problems.
Right.
Well, maybe we are skewing our question a little bit by asking about academia, because that has its own set of issues and conservative, resistant to change, a strange thing for an institutions interested in new knowledge and being resistant to change, but I think a lot of them are, even so.
Right, but it's a self-fulfilling problem in a way, because we're the people who are educating the next generation. So the only way we're going to change the next generation is if we increase our numbers as well.
Right. Let's take one more call or another call. Let's go to Jean in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I wanted to bring up a study that I heard about in the early to mid-80s. I think it was the American Association of University Women who had done the study. And they were trying to find out why women who were succeeding in math and science in high school weren't going on in college. And what they did was to send researchers out to high school classrooms across the country, classrooms taught by women, classrooms taught by men. And what they found was that even though roughly equivalent percentages of girls and boys were getting A's or B's in the math and science, they were being rewarded for different behaviors in the classroom. The girls were rewarded when they got the right answer, and the boys were rewarded for taking chances and throwing out hypotheses, even if they were off the mark, but they were risk-taking. And it struck me at the time as incredibly enlightening, because when you're at the high school level, of course, success really is just mastering the material. But as you go on in college and in higher study of science, you need to be able to take risks and be confident about making mistakes, or that if you make a mistake, you will not be penalized for it. So that was one thing I just wanted to throw out to see if anybody else had heard about it. The other quick thing I wanted to mention was there's someone, I believe, at Stanford who's been studying the structuring of the SATs, looking at the difference between questions when they're field tested and then questions as they're finally administered. And he's been finding that questions that favor African-American students are actually dropped off the final exams, and that questions that favor girls over boys are often dropped off the final exams.
Wow.
So again, that's self-fulfilling, because you know, one of the things that's been cited all week about Professor Summers is, we'll look at the SATs, but if you have the structure of the exam created to fulfill what people expect, then of course you're going to have boys scoring higher.
Before I ask one of my guests to respond to that interesting point, I need to remind people that we're talking about the difficulties that women face in pursuing a career in science, and that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, I don't know, Nancy Hopkins, did you speak earlier, I believe it was you, about the fact that even though people are going on and getting their undergraduate degrees, they're leaking out at some later point?
Well, I think, you know, again, from the MIT study, what we found was that for young women, the concerns about family were a major issue, but for after that, for women who stayed in the system, it was this subtle marginalization and bias that was the big problem. So they had to succeed by achieving more, in a sense. So it was harder work to achieve at the very high level of an MIT professor because of that. And I think the question that she just asked is really interesting, you know, about whether boys are encouraged. And these are the subtle things in the classroom that have such an impact, where these psychologists have shown so convincingly. And that's what we're really so concerned about. Because risk-taking, for example, is enormously important to huge success, particularly in science. Absolutely. And I do think it's a concern. And I think part of it is you can take risks if you know you're part of the system. But if you are a person who's kind of on the margins of the system, risks have a higher risk.
Yeah.
So it's a real issue.
No, it's an interesting point, Jean. Thanks for bringing that up. We've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to ask each of you to look forward and say, you know, there clearly have been changes in the last few years. Can you picture a time, how many years do you think it is before we get to parity, or will we ever get to parity between men and women? Maybe I could start with you, Nancy Hopkins.
Well, what we have seen is that we can fix these problems. We can make tremendous progress. There is a great deal of a better understanding about it, and that these are not innate differences at the moment. They're societal issues. And so I think it's very encouraging that this has been brought to the light and so many people are interested in it. I think that's wonderful.
Dr. Bronner-Fraser, what about you?
I agree. I think since we've been paying attention to this, and this is largely due to Nancy and the MIT report initiating this whole process, there have been many positive changes. At my institution, there's been an increase in the professorial numbers of women. There's been an increase in women in administration. And so I'm very optimistic that things will change. Will we hit parity? Well, at some point, perhaps, maybe not in our lifetimes, but I think as long as we continue to pay attention to this as an issue, it can be improved.
Okay, and Dr. Urey, you get the final word here.
I'm really quite optimistic, and the reason is because there are so many brilliant young women who are attracted to science and keen to do it, and they're flooding into the field, and frankly, I don't think they'll be denied. And so I think we have to encourage them. We have to tell them to follow their dreams and not to let anyone discourage them. And maybe, I don't know if some of them are even listening to your program, we need to remind them that women tend to underestimate their abilities, men tend to overestimate their abilities, and women tend to get more discouraged than men about whether they can do something. Should that happen to them, they need to realize it's kind of a gender thing and forget about it and get on with their work.
Okay.
And that's the way we'll get to parity.
Dr. Urey, I have to stop you there. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank my guest this hour. Meg Urey is a professor of physics at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. We also spoke with Nancy Hopkins, from the Amgen, Inc. professor of biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, and Dr. Marianne Bronner-Fraser, Ruddock Professor of Biology at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. Thanks to all of you very much. This is an interesting topic, and I'm sure we can do this show once a year, and it'll be something new each time.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
This program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Bergquist is our director and our web producer. Our interns are Corey Binns and Todd Neal. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. For internet mail, you can email us. The address is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you from audible.com or the iTunes Music Store. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum material for teachers, science teachers using Science Friday. Just click on the teachers link on sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.